warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This is the series entitled Back in Time, and in these episodes we shall be discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in our exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's very welcome guest, I should mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom. So if you do hear a few noises in the background, you'll understand why. So helping us in our explorations today is Dr. Reuben Griemer. Dr. Griemer is senior lecturer within the Department of Conservation and Built Heritage at the Faculty for the Built Environment at the University of Malta. Today's theme is archaeology and landscapes, and Dr. Griemer is going to talk about why landscapes matter and archaeology's place within our contemporary landscapes, and he will be referring also, I imagine, to international conventions and the latest trends in the philosophy of archaeology today. So, on with my first query. A few definitions really never go amiss, so I'll ask you for the first one. What do you really understand by landscape?
Well, thank you. Thank you for your introduction. It's a great pleasure to be with you and your listeners today. And thank you for asking that question, because it really is fundamental. Because the key point about landscape is that it may mean different things to different people. And this is not simply quibbling with words, but it is a central, fundamental point. The very term landscape, even the origin of the word, which apparently comes from Middle Dutch and enters English usage by the 16th century, is about a view or a painting. So, the term itself implies a way of seeing a place. So it's not simply a description of a place, but it implies a point of view, which of course may be different according to the different observers and the different cultures that they belong to, which is why the whole idea of landscape is immensely interesting in the study of past as well as present societies, because it tells us a great deal about people's way of engaging with their world. To make the point in a different way, you don't have a landscape unless you have an observer, because landscapes, in this sense, only exist in our mind.
So why do you think landscapes are important, really, then, to the study of the past? What is that link?
Yes, this is absolutely fundamental. Human activity unfolds in an environment, a landscape setting. And many of the decisions that people take, and even the cultural responses that they develop, are largely a response to that environment. So it's very, very difficult. It doesn't even make sense to try to understand human behavior without grappling with the environment and the landscape setting which it is unfolding in. Now, a lot of archaeological practice in the 19th and much of the 20th century focused a great deal on the archaeological site. And you even have moments when, as a discipline, we were so engrossed in what happens in our archaeological site, which would have very tight boundaries, sometimes even be fenced off and would have a very precise limit of excavation, that and there would be so much information coming out of an archaeological excavation, which by its nature is a keyhole in the landscape, that at certain moments in the history of our discipline, we may have paid a bit less attention to this wider picture, which the landscape, which the archaeological site forms a part of. But in the last few decades, there has been a great deal of rethinking of this and autocriticism in the discipline, which has underlined how artificial this divide is, this boundary is. And for the past few decades, any intervention in a single site is recognized as part of a much larger mosaic. And there's this much stronger awareness that even the micro-reality, which an excavation can reveal, can only be made sense of when seen in relation to what is happening in other parts of the landscape. Because you could have a totally different picture emerging if you're excavating merely a couple of kilometers away in a different part of the same setting. And the narrative that you come up with for a post-society could be changed dramatically when you take that wider picture. So
these are the new trends in how we look at archaeology.
Well, it has quite a long genesis, so we could explore a few key trends in approaches to the landscape in archaeology. And if you go back even to antiquarians and even 19th century archaeologists, you often find passing comments about the wider landscape. So there is an awareness of the importance of that wider setting. As the discipline of stratigraphic excavation becomes more developed and you have a great deal of attention, and even in the early 20th century, a great deal of resources being poured into investigating monuments in particular. And this, of course, is tied with the history of nationalism and imperialism, where you define the monument and you excise it from the wider landscape. There is a period in the late 19th, early 20th century when more importance is being given to the micro and that wider picture is being neglected. An important turning point when, again, landscapes become central to this discipline is the post-war period, when people like Tim Potter in particular, working in Etruria, largely because the industrialization of agriculture in Italy in the post-war period was churning up archaeological sites because of deeper mechanical plows, which were destroying sites which had been left undisturbed for millennia. Realizing that, Tim Potter and his colleagues saw the importance of surveying much larger areas rather than just focusing on the major iconic archaeological excavation on a single site. And this is when the discipline of field walking was developed. And it's still a very important tool today, where essentially you walk across the surface of different fields, and depending on how recently they've been plowed or how recently it's rained, and depending on the amount of vegetation growing, you will get insight into the cultural signals which may have accumulated in that landscape in the past, most typically in the form of pottery scatters, you know, fragments of ceramic vessels which had been broken and abandoned in the past in those areas, which can give a very, very rich signal across time of the intensity of human activity in a specific area. Of course, one also needs to take into account all the factors which could be erasing that signal or concealing that signal. But effectively, that approach allows you to read the landscape as a palimpsest in which successive cultures are overwriting the landscape for their different needs as they exploit it for their different purposes, and leaving this cumulative signal, which which can still be read through tools like field walking. More recently, since the 1960s, we've seen the rise of environmental sciences as a absolutely critical contributor to archaeological understanding. And specialists in different environmental sciences, so specialists who study pollen, insects, snails, sedimentology and soils, all have an immensely important contribution to make to the reconstruction of past environments, which allow the cultural evidence to be read against the evidence of these changing environments. And of course, nowadays, with the growing public awareness of environmental change, this is an absolutely important part of the story, because it allows us to see the time depth of how environments have been changing over the millennia. Environments have never stopped changing, and climate change has been a permanent reality as long as humans have inhabited the Earth. It's simply the realization that this is something which may be now accelerating because of our increased ability to impact those environments, which is what characterizes our current crisis. But living with change is something which, looking at the past, can really shed light on. And there are different settings in which humans have proved to be more resilient in coping with that change, or more vulnerable. You have cases of collapse and cases of successful adaptation. Like one recent project which has been undertaken in the Maltese landscape is the Fraxas project, which has explored fragility and sustainability in the Maltese prehistoric environment primarily. And this is exploring precisely these themes, which was the main purpose of that, and looking at how primarily the Maltese temple culture coped with change, but in the end how it was doomed to collapse because it could not successfully adapt to the growing stress caused both by human exploitation of the environment and even environmental change.
Yes, I love looking at the Fraxas maps of the diagrams of the field walking that was done. You look at those diagrams and you sort of look at the whole history of that, of the area that they've walked over. And you can see it reflected in the sherds that were found in the field walking, sort of stratigraphy on the horizontal rather than the vertical.
Absolutely. And that whole tradition in environmental reconstruction, again, is just one strand in archaeological approaches to landscape. We could mention other trends, not just to broaden the picture. So another important strand is the work coming from geographers in particular, who have done a great deal of work in modeling the economics of landscape and landscapes of production, which again, environmental reconstruction feeds into. And so those two things move hand in hand. Yet another strand which has been given more attention in the last two or three decades. And this was really since the 1990s that this became central again, is how people experience landscape. So you have the idea of phenomenology. That is, how do people, even on a daily basis, think about and experience their environment? And this is a rich theme, again, even for the study of the past and past societies and their experience of place, because it allows insight into landscapes of ritual and landscapes of belief. And we can see this even from ethnography, from the evidence of present-day societies. We know that in just think of, for example, the importance of the river Ganges in Hinduism, where an element of the landscape, a river in this case, is an important ingredient in a belief system. And if you think of past societies, there is no end of such examples. So Mount Olympus for the Greeks, or Moses going on to Mount Sinai for his encounter with the divine. And that's the moment when the commandments are given. So, and again, even in China, the idea of sacred mountains is a recurrent theme. Likewise in Japan. So the adoption of elements of the landscape as places which have cosmological significance, which are not just part of our material geography, but even are part of our cosmography, our way of understanding our place in the universe, is a recurrent idea across many different societies. Armed with that understanding, when we look at past societies, even where we do not have written sources, as we do in the case of the Greek world and the idea of Mount Olympus, for instance. But even if we're looking at prehistoric societies, we can begin to catch glimpses that the way the landscape is being ordered and understood is also assigning cosmological significance to features of the landscape. And again, to draw an example from the Maltese context, the positioning of the Maltese prehistoric temples in their environment is not casual. And it does suggest an interest in looking at the boundary between land and sea, and also the relationship with the more productive parts of the island. So, and this, one could equally draw examples from other megalithic sites across Europe, where, to use Richard Bradley's phrase, the insertion of a monument in the landscape is altering the earth, is transforming the environment, and giving it new significance. And so incorporating that setting into a belief system. And again, we may, with our modern mind, think of a separation, think of it as distinct entities, and make a siloed separation between the ritual and the mundane, that which is concerned with production and subsistence. But drawing on ethnographic work, an important idea in understanding constructions of the environment are that the landscapes of production and subsistence and daily life are often inseparable from the landscapes of belief, that in many pre-industrial societies, these were a seamless continuum. A beautiful word which sums this up is given to us by Tim Inger. It's the idea of taskscapes, as the environment in which we perform our daily tasks is also unfolding in a setting which may have ritual significance. So just think of in the early modern landscape in Malta, where wayside chapels and niches with divinities are dotted across the landscape, and a farmer on his way to his field, or a shepherd, would not stop to think that he or she is departing from the world of subsistence and production and entering the world of the ritual. But it was a seamless whole, which was the way that they gave meaning to their daily routine. maps and experience of the landscape, if that makes sense.
Modern archaeologists have to really try and think in ways that take them right out of their cultural comfort zone and make them look at archaeology and the landscape and try and interpret what might have been the cultural position of people who lived very differently to us and had belief systems different to us. So it's obviously one, as you say, one can take a lot of help, get a lot of help from various ways, especially texts when it's possible, but in prehistory not always possible. So the relationship that people had in the past with their environment was not like ours, really. So I think that's something that we have to battle against a bit, you know, to really open one's mind to looking at what might have been. So why should landscapes matter, and what measures are being taken to safeguard these landscapes?
Yes, of course, here we're galloping on to the relevance of landscapes to people today, aren't we? So, which is also vital to get to grips with. Landscapes are an ingredient of people's lives today as well. So the short answer to why do landscapes matter could be landscapes matter because people live in them. And that's why landscapes should matter to people. And this is summed up quite elegantly in a Council of Europe convention called the European Landscape Convention, which was launched in 2000 and came into force in 2004, which now has over 40, or exactly 40 signatories among the member states of the Council of Europe, who have signed, ratified, and brought this convention into force. And the heart of that convention is that landscapes need to be safeguarded because they are an integral element of the quality of life of people today as in the past. And that convention also makes the point that it is not just about the safeguarding of the pristine and the most beautiful landscapes, but even about the ordinary, about the most degraded, dirty, industrialized, damaged, worn landscapes. Because those are the ones which may need most attention and where often the degradation of those landscapes is most impacting people's lives. So it's quite a package of revolutionary ideas which were packed into that one convention. And another instrument I could mention is the World Heritage Convention, which since around 1992 introduced the idea of the cultural landscape. So whereas until that point you either had cultural sites or natural sites or mixed sites, a cultural landscape was by definition a synthesis between human activity and the environment. So you have sites like the Lake District, for instance, inscribed, where the poets and painters and their encounter with the Lake District are absolutely integral to why the Lake District is significant for humanity. You also have some quite challenging inscriptions. One we could mention, a fairly recent inscription, is the Bamiyan Valley in Afghanistan, which is where the Bamiyan Buddhas were destroyed by the Taliban in 2001. The interesting thing is that the valley which they form a part of was inscribed on the UNESCO World Heritage List after the destruction of the Buddhas. And the loss of the Buddhas is itself included as one of the reasons for inscription, because it is a document of what can happen when you have intolerance and misunderstanding between cultures. So these Buddhas, which had survived for well over a millennium in a an environment of different cultures, different belief systems, rubbing shoulders against each other without it being a problem. Because of this moment of intolerance and fundamentalism, are now lost forever. And this is where the World Heritage Convention and inscriptions such as the Bamiyan Valley can really make people think. So it's not just like a beauty contest where we have a list like the 1,000 wonders of the world, because there's over 1,000 sites on the list now, but inscriptions which make people sit up and think about what matters and about how people relate to each other.
I'm always going on about sight lines here in Malta, like, for example, the tombs of the Punic tombs of Alleluia, looking over the valley, because the belief system of the time was that the soul should look over a water course. Same thing with the Punic tombs at Marisa, overlooking the harbour, or Tassilj, overlooking the sea, so that it could be seen from the sea from far away. Sight lines, you can't really, you can draw them on a map, I suppose, but they're not something you can hold in your hand. So it's difficult to suggest to people that sight lines might be important. In the last couple of, literally, few minutes that we have, what about actual safeguarding of these sight lines? It's not an easy thing to do in anywhere, and not in Malta.
Well, in the context of Malta, this is immensely challenging. We have one of the most densely populated states on the globe, with an immense wealth of archaeological resources and a varied and beautiful landscape, and also an obsession with building construction, which has been given free rein in quite short-sighted ways. And policymakers have often made the mistake of setting up progress in opposition to conservation. And that's extremely short-sighted, because, and even setting up economic wealth as if it is in tension with conservation. So we're led to believe that this is losing this environment, and these qualities of the landscape are a price we have to accept paying in order to achieve progress and economic wealth. But that is really misleading. It's a state of mind, because the environment and the landscape are absolutely essential to our quality of life and well-being, which is absolutely integral to economic well-being and long-term economic well-being. Remember, economy means, the etymology of the word is the rules of the household, the management of the household. And if we cannot take care of the upkeep of our household, then our economy is a non-starter. So we really have to break down that binary opposition and embrace the sacred duty to give priority to environmental and landscape conservation as a responsibility to future generations and their quality of life.
Well, we're running out of time, and I shall have to close this really fascinating conversation. And I'd like to thank Dr. Ruben Bremer for being with us today, and I hope that our listeners will join me again next week, when we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.